Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. Episode 20, Closing the Disadvantage Gap in Schools with Finola Wilson.
Welcome back everyone to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. For those of you who've been with us since the very beginning, you may remember in, I want to say, season two, Tom?
Certainly pre-COVID times.
Certainly pre-COVID, a fantastic episode where we travelled to Caerphilly to meet with Jane and Finola of Impact Wales to talk all about Impact Wales. And actually, Finola Wilson has joined us back in the podcast studio all these years later. Feels like a long time, Finola. How are you?
It does feel like a very long time. But yeah, I'm good. I'm thrilled to be here.
And you're here today to talk to us about a book that you have written that has been published by Routledge, Closing the Disadvantage Gap in Schools, a Visual Workbook. Now, before you sort of tell us a little bit about the book and we sort of take a deep dive into it, I said before we started rolling that it feels like this has been a long time coming. It feels like this is maybe an itch that you've really needed to scratch and it's taken time to sort of really get your thoughts straight on this. And now the book is the fruits of that labour. Am I right?
Well, it's certainly the book itself has been 18 months in the making, because it takes a surprisingly long amount of time to actually go through the whole process. But I think Jane and I have been working on professional learning, obviously, since 2015. Mm. And our website has got lots of professional learning packs and stuff like that. Sorry, not a promo. But it's it's thinking about that what is it that teachers need? That's always what we're doing. And I think that the opportunity just came up with Closing the Disadvantage Gap to do something a little bit longer. And I have in the past pitched books to publishers and they haven't bitten. And this one they bit on, because I'm thinking that this is Closing the Disadvantage Gap is just so important post-COVID that I just think it was the right subject at the right time. And they said, yes, let's do that.
Actually, let's ditch not a promo, actually, because I think we probably assume, because you're such an institution around these parts, that everyone's going to know who you are. But Impact Wales, I mean, we see your stuff everywhere. I mean, we see it probably in places it's not supposed to be sometimes, your sketch notes. So that's a bit of a sore point with you sometimes, isn't it? Your stuff pops up everywhere. But just quick run through for the listener who hasn't heard about you.
Yes.
Impact Wales.
Well, Impact Wales. So it's not just me. It's me and my colleague Jane. And we're both former teachers. And we set up together after we were on a Welsh Government contract that finished a little bit earlier than we were expecting, and neither of us wanted to go back to school. So we set up Impact Wales to carry on supporting schools. And well, that was in September of 2015, and we're still going 10 years later. So yeah, that's us.
And famous for your sketch notes. I was reading a governor's report to parents of a school that shall remain nameless, and I saw something in there. I thought, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a snip from a Finola sketch note.
Yes, they are everywhere. We have fairly regular conversations with publicly funded bodies about our sketch notes being used without our permission. But, you know, it's in a way, it's a massive compliment. We don't endorse that, but it is a massive compliment that they are so widely shared and used.
Something that Lucy Crehan touches upon in the foreword for this book, and she nails it for me, having read your book, is that there are a lot of books that deal with closing the disadvantage gap in schools that give a lot of detail about what the disadvantage gap is, why these particular learners face particular challenges, but perhaps leave the classroom teacher wanting to know, well, how, what is it that I can do? And it can feel quite big and overwhelming. I remember feeling this way as a student teacher myself, as a teacher in the classroom, that, you know, how am I possibly going to close the disadvantage gap when I am but a humble classroom teacher? I obviously know now that I made a big difference and I had the power to make a big difference. But your book does so well is that it speaks to not only school leaders, but also the classroom teachers. So tell us, because she picks up on this in the foreword, tell us about how you structured the book, the kind of form and structure of the book, and why you decided to do it that way.
Okay, so there are three kind of elements to being a really, really good teacher. And I think there's a sort of a narrative out there that you just need to have a really great toolbox and just have really great tools in your toolbox that you can just pick up and use it with your classroom. And actually, that's not the case, because you need to know why you would be using that tool, what's good about it, why it's better than something else, and when to use it. So you need to know, you need to understand how learning happens, what education actually is, what the children's experience is. You need that kind of foundational understanding of child development, of, you know, psychological and educational development. But that sounds really overwhelming. So what I've tried to do in the book is to pull out some key principles from research, you know, some key papers from research, and just say, look, these are the really important things that you need to know and understand, then help you make sense of those really practical tools. This is what you need to do. But then we also need to have a section or a part of any book that actually starts that process, because teaching practice improves through practice. It doesn't improve through just reading something. So it would be great if you could just pick up a book, read it cover to cover, and go, right, I'm done. I know how to do this now. You need to actually go back into your classroom and practice those things again and again and again until they become habitual. And that's what I've tried to do in this book, is just to give people reading it, whatever stage of teaching they're at, that, right, go and try this and think about this when you do it. Now come back. What did you think about? What's next? So it's not just simply a try this and you're off. It's that whole deliberate practice process, which can be, did you know, little fun fact here, habits take between 18 and 254 days to create. So, you know, if you're at the wrong end of that, that's probably more than a teaching year, and doing it every single day. Mm. So, you know, this is not a short process. You have to be very, very focused on it. So that's what I tried to do in the book.
We've talked about the disadvantage gap a fair bit off and on here on the podcast. We've talked to various people from different angles. You know, this idea that kids from disadvantaged background are sort of, it's really sticky, that gap. It's a real struggle. They don't do as well as people from the more advantaged backgrounds. And sometimes when we talk about it, people are saying, oh, you know, curriculum, it's all about curriculum. Some people are saying, no, it's nothing to do with curriculum. It doesn't matter what curriculum you've got. Mm. It's the teaching. Other people are saying, it's all about the teaching. Good teaching is the sort of number one thing. Some people are saying, well, actually, do you know what? It's all a bit of a distraction if we don't fund the stuff that these disadvantaged people need, and the teachers are just kind of papering over cracks they shouldn't have to paper. I mean, you're somebody who's done the reading, done the research, and also spends a huge amount of time in schools, so you've kind of been down at the sharp end as well. I mean, firstly, in terms of kind of what this looks like in reality, because we, you know, we can look at graphs, we can look at numbers and, you know, cry over them getting wider and all that kind of thing, but what does this look like on the ground on a human level? And where do you stand on where the actual magic for fixing or mitigating this may lie in terms of, you know, what's number one, or what's the spread? What's the kind of balance?
Okay, so I'm just going to you'll have to come back to me on the first half of that. I'm going to look at the second half of that first, which is the where does it actually start? And I think we all need to be honest that it starts way before school. Mm. It starts probably prenatal. You know, this is what happens to children while they're in pregnancy, that's what is really important. And this is not something that schools can fix on their own. But obviously, the expectation that they do something about it is not going to go away. It is an expectation. It's often a recommendation from inspection. It's often an expectation from, you know, school priorities. So teachers do have to do something about it. What we see so often, and you see it, it's not just when you go into a school, but it's in funding grants, it's in Senedd discussions, it's everywhere throughout the education system, is that because disadvantage is so difficult to accurately measure, what happens is it gets measured as poverty. Mm. And, you know, we have in Wales, unfortunately, we have the eligibility for free school meals measure, which actually has disappeared for primary schools. So that's a bit of an issue. But what you're doing is you're saying this child is disadvantaged because they come from a poor, financially poor background. But disadvantage is so much bigger than that. You're going to have children who come from very advantaged backgrounds who financially who are actually disadvantaged. So I think what you see on the ground is a sort of addressing of some symptoms, but a lack of understanding of what it is that causes disadvantage. You know, when you haven't got much money and your mum maybe is a single mum and she's out working three jobs and she doesn't have the energy, or she's struggling and she hasn't got the time or is short with you, that's disadvantage. But also similarly, you live in a very wealthy background where both of your parents are working very high-powered jobs, and maybe there's a little bit of, you know, sort of toxic dynamic going on in that background. That's also disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So it's important that schools understand that this isn't about how much money a child has. Those things are important, you know, having clean clothes and all of that. But this is more about whether they can reap the full benefit of their education or not. That's essentially what educational disadvantage is. And I think that's the problem in schools. Now, have I answered the first part of that question or not? I'm not sure I have.
I think you have, because the first part, I think you've answered the first part. It was like, what are the indicators of, like, how do we know, like,
right.
How are we characterising disadvantage? But then I think Tom was talking about what are the things that we should be chasing that make a difference then,
right.
Which is the obvious next place to go. But I wanted to sort of intercept before we get there, because based on what you've just said, you've got this great chapter that comes a bit later in the book on using data to guide what you do. Mm-hmm. And you make a really good point that, you know, we get an abundance now of quantitative data. Mm. But much like this sort of blunt tool indicator that, or metric that we use to identify those who are disadvantaged, that's not the full story, is it, the stats? You make a really big case in the book for qualitative data. Like, who are these kids? Mm. So where should a school start, and where does the classroom teacher fit in with that, about, you know, who are these kids? Mm. And therefore, what do we know about the disadvantages that they face?
And I think that's a really important question that you've identified, that the school and the teacher, in fact, they probably should be the same thing. Mm. Because so often you get school data, which actually sits separate to the teacher. Mm. And that shouldn't be the case, because the school data is for the teacher to use to decide what it is those children need. So in terms of school data, you will obviously have your standardised reading tests, which are really important. Reading ages are, you know, one of the key indicators of later academic success. Mm. But you'll have, you know, national attainment tests. You'll have maybe secondary, you'll have GCSE results. You'll also have maybe internally, you'll have your teacher assessments based on what you're teaching them. Are they making progress against what you're teaching them? But I think we also need to recognise that as a class teacher, you'll have things like behaviour. I mean, reading and behaviour, or lack of reading ability, often is correlated with poor behaviour. Because children who can't read and haven't been able to read for a long time have learnt strategies to get out of reading, because it's, you know, it's a really difficult place for them to be. So having this really, like you say, this really wide whole child data set, and it doesn't need to be onerous. It's something maybe you've already got, but just saying, you know, if we use class charts, let's just have a check against those children who've got a reading age of more than 9 months below their chronological age. How many of them are also having regular input into class charts to say that they're not doing okay in terms of behaviour? Just getting a picture of, excuse me, how many children are in, you know, what level of change in terms of who are your quick wins? Who could you just upskill them a little bit in reading, give them some maybe emotional regulation strategies, and they would fly. And then focus on those who are really struggling more at the bottom end, who maybe their CAT scores, maybe their potential isn't quite where you'd want it, but they're also struggling academically and maybe behaviour is beginning to show up as well. So you've got, you know, having that full picture helps you to work out the strategy that you're going to use, not just at school level, but class teacher as well.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because we're We're hearing a lot about behaviour at the moment. We've got a behaviour summit going on, haven't we? Welsh Government's, is it behaviour summit? I don't know, just anecdotally, we go into schools and a lot of schools are having a big sort of post-COVID behaviour reset, lots of sort of concentration on whole school behaviour policies, which are often sort of quite sort of influenced by certain books and things. And what you're saying is that's more likely to be the symptom and not so much the cause. That's more of a downstream thing.
Well, we're seeing lots of the schools that we're working with at the moment are getting comments in inspection reports, things like pupils are very passive, they're not engaging, easily distracted, low-level disruption. And of course, as a class teacher, low-level disruption is like the bane of every teacher's life, is, you know, stop talking. But this is, when you look at things like cognitive load theory, you look at the symptoms of overload, cognitive overload, it's things like low-level distraction, place-keeping errors, or failure to follow instructions, unwillingness to answer questions, and essentially poor progress over the long term. So this is the responsibility of teachers to just say, okay, so we can see that there's a behaviour issue. Yes, some of this will be driven by COVID, some of it will be driven by mental health issues, some of it is outside the teacher's remit. But it's always, you know, you don't get children coming into your school and you say, oh, well, they're just so disengaged. Oh, I just can't do anything with them. No, it's still your responsibility that they need, what support would they benefit from? Could it be that you reduce their cognitive load and it allows them the ability to engage more easily? That, you know, yes, they're coming with issues, but it's still your responsibility to identify how you can help.
And that's making me think about the chapter that you've got about high expectations and culture. Mm. Because to a certain extent, a classroom teacher can influence the culture of their classroom, how things go down in there, the environment, behaviour, you know, even like overstimulation in terms of displays, all of those things. But if the culture of that school isn't one of high expectations, one which really has taken the time to address unconscious and conscious biases that all staff, even senior leaders who think that they, who maybe even come from the community that they serve, there's a lot of work to be done first, it feels like, to go on that journey to create an environment where all pupils, not just disadvantaged pupils, but, you know, and not just advantaged pupils, everybody can thrive. So you make some really good recommendations in the book around that work on culture. And I wonder if you could just give us some insights on that.
I think the thing with culture is it's really difficult to kind of grab hold of what does that mean? What does it look like? And then how do you actually change it? And when you think about culture, it is, yes, there's this kind of underlying, well, what are our values? What's our mission? You know, what's written in our policies? But actually, Jane and I say this all the time, when you go into a school, the culture hits you the minute you walk in the door, the second you walk in the door. There have been notable schools, PRUs that we've walked into that we go, oh my God, I'd love my child to come here. It's so calm and so ordered. And there are other, you know, quite positive, supposedly, schools that you walk into, you go, oh my gosh, I don't feel safe. But how you recognise what culture is like in a school is you look at tangible evidence. You look at what's the building like, what are the displays on the wall like. But then you also think about things like norms. So when, you know, when things go wrong and things don't go to plan, what is the default mode of teachers? You know, when somebody kicks off in class and they're all a little bit flustered, what do they say? Because that's what the culture is really about. And I think it's that, you know, it's the stick of rock business. It's got to be through every single person in school. And when you see these big policy documents with a vision that is 3 or 4 paragraphs long, that's not a vision. A vision should be as simple as, well, we're Impact Wales because we aim to have impact. If it's not going to make a difference, we don't do it. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of really clear, I know exactly what I'm doing. So all the children in my class, they all have to reach this level. So my focus is on making sure that those children who are going to struggle with it the most have got the most support to do it. But I'm thinking very carefully about how am I going to take that away as their expertise grows?
And I suppose somebody who doesn't know the work that's gone into that wouldn't necessarily see it. It could look really simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understood this better by talking to Kelly Bubbins, one of the senior leaders at Willows, where, you know, on face value, you could come into some of those classrooms and think, oh, gosh, this is a bit of a culture shock to me. I'm not sure what I think about this. But actually, there's a lot of work that goes on underneath that. Okay, well, why have we decided to do it in this way? And the understanding that the classroom teachers and the pupils, she talked a lot about how they had to bring parents, carers, the community with them. And I think you're spot on in that point about, you know, you can feel it, but you do get tangible evidence even outside of the community. She talked about one of the bus drivers saying, Kelly, what's going on in Willows? Yeah. What have you been doing to the kids? Because they're so polite, they're so articulate. So, you know, it extends out, but you could quite easily as well, and this comes back to something else that feels like a bit of a theme that runs through the book about those strategies that are really appealing. It's a bit like what you're saying about the toolbox. They're really appealing because you can understand them quickly, they're quite gimmicky, they're easy for learners to kind of catch on to. But without the understanding underneath it, things could fall down. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, what you're talking about is a lethal mutation. You're talking about when somebody takes a strategy or a tool from their toolbox without the foundational understanding, and they then kind of adapt that tool in the moment or maybe over time beyond the realms of what's possible for that tool. So this is where you get retrieval practice and say, right, everybody's going to do retrieval practice and they're going to do it at the beginning of their lesson, and it's always going to look at what they did the last lesson. And that happens, and they find that progress isn't made because they're not thinking strategically enough. Well, why are they remembering that? What are we recalling? Is it really as low stakes as it needs to be? And I think it's essentially like looking at, I always come back to running because I'm a runner and I did a lot of coaching and in another part of my life. It's when you see a really, really good runner, it's effortless. They just look like a gazelle. But the hours and hours of training and drills and all of that they've put in to make it look effortless. And then you see somebody who isn't a good runner. And you can tell, you know, children at the park, you can tell those who are regularly out running around and those who aren't. And I think that's the point, is that you've got to build that understanding of, why am I doing this? You know, a question we often ask schools, invariably ask schools, is, well, how do you think learning happens? You know, if you don't know how it happens, how can you support it to happen? And this is the point behind the strongest lever for closing the disadvantage gap is high quality teaching. And you're right, if you get it right for your disadvantaged pupils, you're also getting it right for everybody else. But understanding why it's important for disadvantaged pupils is essential to know which part of effective teaching is really, really important. Because I think one of the things with the kind of, we'll use this strategy, it'll really work, is thinking about which part of the learning process is it that pupils are struggling with. Because let's take an example of a pupil. Mm-hmm. So you've got a pupil, she was adopted early on in her life. She actually was adopted into a nice middle-class family, so they're financially stable, and they're in a nice, a well-appointed school, so it's not a disadvantaged school. But what's happened is she was, her home life, her mother divorced quite early on, and then she took up with a new partner, and the new partner has psychological issues, is a little bit of a drinker. The mother also turns to drink to manage that. And her home life is chaos, absolute chaos. So she then starts to struggle to actually come into lessons. When she comes into lessons, she's very withdrawn and she doesn't engage. And I suspect that a lot of these children who are described as passive, they're passive because they're struggling. They're struggling to cope. So the most important for those children is engagement. So how do you build engagement? You build engagement through full engagement tasks where it is almost impossible for that child to not engage. So things like choral responses. So if they don't know the answer, they hear someone else saying it next to them, they're still learning because they're taking on that response. Or mini whiteboards where you ask a question, they write down their answer, they draw a picture, they hold it up. It's very low stakes, but it's still learning and everybody is thinking, because that's the point. Learning is thinking, and these pupils are struggling to engage. Then it's not that they haven't got the learning or that they're not bright or they haven't got the potential, it's they're struggling to engage. And that allows you to say, well, we don't need 500 strategies for closing the disadvantage gap. We just need to focus on one, do it really, really well, bridge that gap, get them engaged, and then what's next?
Not unconnected to those points you've just made about maybe not doing the full sort of job of looking at the detail behind some of this research-informed stuff, and also the potential of pupils ending up in a situation where they might be able to disengage. This is something I think we've only kind of poked once, an elephant in the room. You have come off the fence to some extent about setting, which is interesting. I know we talked to Cameron Stewart about this when we talked about maths, because that's where you see it most often, I think, isn't it? It's almost impossible to dislodge the idea that we should be setting in maths. Tell us what side of the fence you came off there.
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of research out there around setting and banding and streaming and, you know, who it benefits and how it advantages some people over others and so on. And I think essentially setting really advantages the teacher more than anybody. Because, you know, when you think, and I think back, I have actually taught English from, you know, age 6 to A level, but I've also taught maths at GCSE because I've got an A level in it. And it was terrifying. But I think it's understanding that whatever class that you teach is going to be mixed ability. But I'm coming from English, where generally speaking, Key Stage 3 certainly is mixed ability. And then you get to Key Stage 4, progression steps. But, you know, year 10 and year 11, where it might be loosely banded. But, and this is probably a fairly controversial opinion, but it is my opinion based on the research, and it is well evidenced, is that children who are advantaged, MAP pupils, they're going to do well no matter what you do. So we need to actually focus on the pupils who aren't going to do well unless you do something about it, which are the disadvantaged pupils. So, you know, we really need to kind of move away from the MAP agenda and say, what is it that our disadvantaged pupils need the most? If we're going to close the disadvantage gap, we have to focus on that, which means that disadvantaged pupils benefit the most when they are together with high-flying pupils. Now, I'm not saying that we should just then detrimentally affect all these high-flying pupils and put them with, you know, disadvantaged pupils because they're more important. I'm not saying that, because they will also benefit from it. There's lots of research around advantaged pupils actually benefiting from a wide socioeconomic background to their education rather than selective education. You know, it's because education isn't just about academics. It's also about the social element of learning. But I think mixed ability wherever possible, and I know that maths is very difficult, is a very difficult thing, having experienced it, for a teacher to actually teach complete mixed ability, because it's a hierarchical subject, much easier in English or history or whatever. But generally speaking, children benefit more from a wide variety of other peers in their class than being sect by prior attainment.
If I'm going to match you controversial statement for controversial statement, I've often filed setting and streaming along with some types of homework. Yeah. In the box marked, keeps the parents sweet. If I'm perfectly honest, I think sometimes it's done because the parents would, you know, I used to get asked why I didn't give homework as a music teacher by some parents. Mm. And I'd have to explain that it wasn't really anything I could do that was meaningful.
There's a podcast in that, what would you put in the bin? And there's so many things I'd put in the bin because, you know, you can't keep on adding stuff. You've got to take stuff away. And if we're going to focus on social justice, if we're going to make a difference for these unseen children, then we really need to think about what is it that we've got to stop doing, because we can't keep on adding things to teachers' workload. So, yeah, homework, yeah. Setting.
And there's a podcast, there has been a seminar as well on as a teacher, what hills are you going to die on, I think, as well. Mm. You know, is it going to be silent writing for 10 minutes at the start of every lesson? If you're doing music, for example, yeah. You know, are you going to die on that hill? And I think perhaps there are some hills that need to be died on.
yeah. And I think we do have to, if we're having this conversation about closing the disadvantage gap, then let's be sensible. Let's be serious and just say, what's really important here? Is it that, you know, pupils who are already having a very difficult life and potentially if they don't read well, 50% of them will end up in prison. You know, these are our children. Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, you have to face the fact, you have to face the facts, Finola,
okay.
That there is a real amount of expertise and mastery that comes with teaching mixed ability classes. Yes. And in the book, you must have had to make a decision. Okay, so what strategies, approaches, research informed best bets out there are there that I'm going to include in the book that really are going to make a difference to those disadvantaged pupils and that are feasible in a class of 30 plus, mixed ability, multiple ALN, which we know oftentimes will come not just through disadvantage, but, you know, we're dealing with a lot more ALN generally, probably, possibly also through more diagnosis, which is a good thing. That's not an easy task. And so what did you decide was really important to kind of put into the book that might be useful to classroom teachers?
Okay, well, I could just give you all the chapters and I can kind of hear where you're going on this as well. And I think that there's a mental model of how learning happens so that you can see where are the barriers to learning. Mm-hmm. So the process of learning is attending to something. So if you lose focus, you're not going to learn. Okay, so that's number one. The next thing is thinking. If you're not thinking, you're not learning. And the issue with that is the working memory where you do your thinking is really limited. So you have to manage the cognitive load there. So if you overload pupils, which we see so much in schools, then you're not going to learn. But then it's connecting with what you already know. So if you're not bringing in what the pupil already knows, like teaching them a new word using words they don't know, I mean, that's not going to work. And then recalling learning repeatedly so that it sticks. So there's the whole mental model of learning, because it gives you that focus on what do I need to hit to make sure that they are learning. So I need to get them attended, thinking, and so on. But I think one of the key strategies that is really, really important, and I know, Emma, that you feel really strongly about this as well, is oracy. Yeah. And is talking. And there's this really nice piece of research by Sadova and Sedlacek, which looks at the connection between the amount of talk that people engage in and the retention of learning over time. And they divided people into five different groups, and they gave them these lovely names like the chatties and the eagers and the disengaged and the, I can't remember all of them. But essentially what it is those people who are sort of mentally very engaged but not particularly chatty, as compared to those who are maybe not as mentally engaged but super chatty. It's the chatties rather than the reticents who actually learn more. So it's not about mental engagement. It's not about, you know, thinking deeply. It's actually putting those thoughts into words that improves your retention long term. Because the actual process, if you think about, you know, your thoughts in your head, I'm sure listeners will be thinking about this at the time. There was really, really great research by Professor Ethan Cross in his book Chatter, where he talked about your own thoughts in your head. We actually talk to ourselves at the equivalent rate of around about 6,000 words per minute. You think about, you know, the typing speed, which you could probably talk at, is around about 23 to 25, 30 maybe at a push. And the disparity between those two numbers is that when your thoughts go through your head and you're learning something new, the process of going, what is it that I'm learning? What words fit with that? How can I structure it and make sense of it, put it in a logical sequence? That process embeds it in your memory. So it is an act of learning to articulate your thoughts. And of course, the act of articulating your thoughts is a perfect opportunity for a class teacher to formatively assess. So it's, and that's something that I focus on in the book a lot, is let's get strategies, tools that have multiple benefits.
And what comes to life for me there from that example is how, you know, only if you've done the good work about understanding that this is a social, emotional being here that's cognitive, that's looking at all those different dimensions. Can they self-regulate? What are their emotions like? You know, how are they thinking about what we're doing? What is their attention? Where is their attention? Are they ready? All of those intersections come to life in that one perfect example. Like, why are the chatties so chatty? Why are the reticent so reticent? Why are they withdrawn? What, and therefore, what do I need to do? Have I noticed that? What do I need to do? And are some of those kids that are displaying certain behaviours, are they some of my disadvantaged kids? And therefore, what am I going to do? And how is that going to benefit them all? So this is what's so great about the book, I think, is that you lay the foundations first. Mm. So we've got that understanding. So then you can sort of view the strategies through the lens of, you know, understanding a child as a full human, and therefore trying to sort of troubleshoot is not the right word, but to try and make sense of why they might be having difficulty engaging in that talk activity that you've set up.
And I think that's, it's important to say that being a really in-depth educational researcher doesn't make you a better teacher. You know, having, and another controversial opinion here coming, you know, carrying out your own professional research in your classroom doesn't necessarily make you a good teacher. It might do, but it's kind of almost by accident that it will do. What makes you a better teacher is understanding how to teach. And that means you have to understand how children learn. Mm. And whilst I talk about quite a lot of research in the book, I'm not talking about it, you know, in great depth. I'm talking about key foundational principles that come from that research. I'm also not talking about, in a lot of cases, very, very recent research. I'm talking about some research that goes back to the 1890s, because that research, I'm talking about Abel House's forgetting curve, actually underpins so much of the research that came later and creates that foundational principle. You know, we don't need to necessarily, as teachers, keep up with the latest research, but we do need to understand the key foundational principles that come from it.
Lots of dots being joined in my mind here. All this talk about oracy. Talk about oracy. Well, it's oracy about oracy. and the thing you said earlier on about the fact that this data sort of comes down to teachers from the school level, but what kind of goes back the other way makes me think of that age-old question, you know, do we assess what we value so that we value what we assess? Do we value what we assess? And whether perhaps we spend time designing stuff that can be easily captured and sort of sent back in the other direction, when actually, as you say, all this kind of, you know, the pupils articulating their thoughts is so valuable. So how do we as teachers kind of get away from that temptation to create stuff so it can be packaged up and sort of sent back up in back up the other direction and assess something which is genuinely valuable and helpful and can be in some way crystallised and in an unbiased way?
That's a big question.
Sorry.
That's okay.
You've made me do it with all your interesting points.
It's assessment. There's a hot topic, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I think there's a kind of key foundational principle about assessment that isn't generally recognised, is that learning is entirely invisible. So it happens inside a pupil's head. And even if you carry out a really, really good, accurate assessment, you're never going to fully know what's going on inside that pupil's head. The best that you can do is to assess their performance, because the only way you see what pupils, it becomes, you know, visible, what pupils have learnt, is through performance, whether that's an answer to a question or whether it's they've drawn a picture or a conversation or a piece of writing or whatever it is. So I think it's it's being really, really clear. What is it I want them to learn? So your learning intention, and then thinking about how do I expect them to demonstrate that learning to give me a really good picture of it, and that's your learning objective. And your learning objective, and this comes from Jared Cooney Horvath, Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath, who's both a teacher and a neuroscientist. He talks about using active verbs. So saying, I want pupils to understand what they've read. Well, you can't possibly know that. You know, how can you know what they've understood? You can't see it. So you getting pupils to describe what they've read, that will give you a tick list of, well, I expect them to use these words or this sentence structure or talk about this theme or that motif or whatever. So it's having a very, very clear idea of what do you expect children to learn? Therefore, what am I going to teach? And then what am I going to expect in terms of demonstration of their learning? Then I can assess that.
And I suppose the problem around the demonstration bit is to what extent the stakes are high or low. I can give an example from my own practice here. You know, oftentimes I will see pupils in a drama lesson demonstrating their capabilities, their ability, their proficiency in their drama skills, their performance skills, their ability to kind of weave content and form together. As soon as you put them in front of an audience to demonstrate what they know and can do, they don't perform to their best. So, you know, and you make the point in the book as well about, you know, this ongoing process of learning that's happening in front of our eyes as teachers. It can be very frustrating, can't it? When you go, I know you can do it, I've seen you do it. And then it comes to the final performance exam and an examiner comes in, doesn't see any of that. So there's this real dilemma, particularly concerning disadvantaged pupils, because we know that it's a really fair measure. Using an examination is a really fair way of putting everybody, you know, in the same position, give them a fair crack at the whip and understanding what they know and what they can do, how they can apply that knowledge, those skills. However, there is that whole bank of knowledge and understanding that has been witnessed by the teacher that perhaps doesn't come through on the day. You also make the point that's aligned with this in the book that we can be very biased when we are assessing them formatively or when we are teacher assessors. So it feels quite paradoxical that we're the best people to determine as teachers the progress that pupils are making. Yes, it's flawed. Exams are a really fair way of, you know, being the culmination of all of that. However, that's not the full story. So what do we do?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that. But I think all your points are really valid. And I think one of the questions is if you see a pupil who, you know, they know it, you know, they know it. They've demonstrated in lots of different ways. And yet in that moment, they don't do it. It doesn't mean they haven't learnt it. And essentially, you know, exams are really important. They take pupils on to the next step in their learning. But really, the more important point is, have they actually learnt what you wanted them to learn? So, you know, one of the questions you could ask yourself is that if they aren't able to perform in that moment, have they learnt it well enough? You know, do they... Because what you want is you want learning to be so strong, so deeply embedded that it's impossible to forget. So, you know, if I asked either of you two, what's the emergency telephone number for the UK? You'd be able to give the answer. You can't not tell me it's 999. That's what we want for pupils, is for their learning to be so deeply embedded that the performance isn't an issue for them, because they know it back to front, inside out. They've got that adaptive expertise. We don't just want to coach them to be able to do a performance and then, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks later, 6 months later, a year later, they've forgotten what they've learned, or they've forgotten what they were coached to be able to regurgitate, because they might need it in later life, you know. So it is always a balance. And I think that, you know, we have to have exams. We have to have exams because that's how the measurement allows the next step in their learning journey. But that's only a snapshot. That the long-term learning is much more important. So it's always going to be the balance between the two. So there's no easy answer.
No.
Sorry, I'm not.
Sorry, I asked it. I had to.
There's an interesting debate doing the rounds at the moment, isn't there? I mean, putting my secondary hat back on, to the annoyance probably of our primary listeners, there's a big sort of debate going on about coursework versus exams at GCSE. And I spend a certain amount of time trying to coax guests in to talk to us about it, but it's difficult at the moment, isn't it? Because obviously it's a live issue at the moment here in Wales, and people don't want to do controversial things like I do. And as you're saying that, you know, all this stuff about exams and all of that, I find myself thinking, well, there is one argument that does the rounds that says disadvantaged kids are going to really struggle with coursework because they've not perhaps got the support systems at home to help them do well in coursework, so we should do more exams. But then, as Emma's rightly saying, and it's making me think, you know, if you've actually got a really disadvantaged background, are you more likely to perhaps have that performance anxiety because maybe your self-esteem is going to be on the quiet a little bit lower because you've got all this kind of baggage in your head that maybe those lucky advantaged kids maybe advantaged in the wider sense that you were talking about earlier on, you know, not just poverty, but all those other kinds of advantage. Maybe they're going to have the confidence to not have that sudden imposter syndrome moment in a high-stakes exam situation. And then I found myself thinking, well, actually, maybe we need to be worrying far more about the kids' sense of their own self-esteem than practically anything else.
Well, do you know, I think the only way to look at the issue is to say that we have what we have. So it's not a question of, well, should we do this or should we do the other? We've got exams. And we know that they are a very fair way of doing it. Coursework is less fair. And we want to make sure that we're thinking very practically, is we want to make sure that we want pupils who are coming from a disadvantaged background to be the least disadvantaged that we can possibly manage it, given the current reality. And I would say that exams is the way to do that. And think about, why is it that they're suffering with anxiety, and give them the skills? Because I think more and more we're seeing that teaching and learning is not just academic. It's not just about retention of information and knowledge. It's an emotional experience. You know, you come at it from an emotional point of view. If you're happy or you're sad or you're stressed, you're cognitive capacity is reduced, you're less able to learn. But it's also about executive functioning skills. I mean, you know, are your pupils struggling with finishing a task or planning how to do a task or keeping going? I mean, we hear this so much, resilience, independence, so much. And it most probably is down to an executive functioning issue. And those skills can be taught. Not separately, not as a, you know, I learn curriculum, but as within the, okay, so if I'm going to write a science report, how would I plan that? What would that look like? How can I prioritise the content I need? Teach them the process through a worked example.
Mm. Okay, we're going to zoom out a little bit now. I'm going to carefully think before I pair share. Lucy Crehan wrote the foreword to this book. We've had her on this podcast on numerous occasions, talking about some of the concerns that she has had and has expressed quite publicly about Curriculum for Wales, and how it may or may not serve disadvantaged pupils in particular for reasons pertaining to things like equity, coherence. They're the two big ones that she talks about a lot. You've got a chapter in the book entitled Small Changes on a Large Scale, which sort of deals with this issue that there might be this sort of big national plan, and this is where we're headed, and that big national plan doesn't necessarily take into account things that might crop up along the way that could cause problems, like a global pandemic. And they don't take into account the sort of specific demands of what it means to implement something, particularly if it's quite aspirational. I'm not being too specific here, you may have noticed.
You did say Curriculum for Wales.
I did. You can cut that out. No, don't cut it out.
You're asking this question, not me. It's very good of you to take one for the team here.
I'm doing it. But the point
I always sound like I'm enjoying them more when I ask these questions than you do.
Yeah, and the thing that hit me right between the eyes from the book, direct quote, is that these sorts of plans, these kind of long-term plans that dictate, you know, how schools and senior leaders within them operate and teachers within them operate, is they can be inflexible and subject to plan continuation bias. So
that's been going around in my head ever since you started this question. Yeah,
that's the plan. That's no, just stick to the plan.
Get their itis.
Get their itis, yeah, that's it exactly. And you've got this, you know,
get
lovely...
Get to wear itis.
You've got yeah, get exactly. to wear itis. You've got a lovely sketch note in the book of a pilot who, yeah. you know, is meets some bad weather, but still doesn't course correct. Like, still yeah. is like, no...
That is actually a real example from a real crash of an aircraft. I mean, and this is what's so interesting, just to interrupt here.
Sure.
Is that quite a lot of the research in the book, well, quite a lot, let's say 10 to 15% of the research in the book actually doesn't come from the education field at all, because we need to understand psychology and we need to understand people, because we're teaching people, not just education. Yeah. And plan continuation bias is one of those things, in that you can, and schools are encouraged, well, not just encouraged to, required to have a 3-year school improvement plan, which often is so, so detailed, and they're going to do this then and they're going to do that then, and then global pandemic comes along and they have to throw the whole thing out and start again. And I think that the other piece of research that's particularly relevant, and particularly relevant for class teachers as well, is called problem-driven iterative adaptation. And I had to close my eyes to think hard about that one, because it's PDIA, and it's basically what it says is choose a problem. Choose a problem for you. So identify something that's not happening the way you want it to happen. Is it that you've got low-level disruption? And solve that problem. And then every time you find that you're getting through, that something's improving, adapt. Maybe you can add something else in, or maybe you can refine it slightly. And this means that you have the opportunity to actually make a difference immediately, but keep on making a difference throughout the process, that you're still focused very much on what the issue is for your school, for your pupils, for your class. Mm. And I think that's so important when we're thinking about closing the disadvantage gap, because there are these projects out there that, you know, that money has been spent on, or you're going to poverty-proof your school or have you. But what if, you know, you get an influx of pupils who've just come from, I don't know, Liberia or Ukraine, who have a different set of problems, but your approach doesn't take that into account. What do you do then? Mm. You know, it's always having the opportunity to adapt to what the needs of the pupils in front of you are.
And were you, to some degree, attempting to give more tangible advice to schools as to what they can do within this climate of a much more high-level curriculum design, far less prescription in terms of content and what a pupil should know, be able to do, have experienced in individual subject discipline from progression step one onwards? Were you... because you have been vocal, Impact Wales have been vocal in this space, rightly so, about some of these issues surrounding Curriculum for Wales, particularly equity and coherence for disadvantaged pupils. Were you, in your way, trying to address this with this chapter of the book, or with this book generally, and in what ways?
Okay, I think the piece of research that I would kind of cite for this is Orsa Pell's subsumption theory, which is what you already know determines what you are able to learn. So if you're coming to school pre-verbal, you have to start there. If you're trying to understand, you know, how to use punctuation, you have to understand that punctuation controls meaning. Not that capital letter starts a sentence. Sorry, bugbear of mine, really annoys me. That you have to start with what's important and then make sure it's learnt before you move on. I mean, you know, Rosenstein's Principles of Instruction talks about the kind of tipping point of when to move on is when 80% of the content has been mastered. It might be 80% of the pupils have mastered 80% of the content. And if you don't do that, pupils are not going to make progress. You know, so many schools, through no fault of their own, are working in an educational system where it's about coverage, not learning. And, you know, if we're going to get serious about closing the disadvantage gap, then children have to learn things. And we have to make sure they're learning things. So we want to not move on until they've learned things. And there's multiple schools that we have been into where we've asked for information about, well, what's your pupil's reading age? And we've been told, well, 60% of our pupils have a reading age more than 9 months below their chronological age. Can't read, you can't learn. And I would say oral interventions are incredibly important for reading success. So I'd probably start with oracy first. Why are you doing anything else? You know, I know that, that's probably a little too revolutionary, but you look at children coming into Welsh medium schools from English medium contexts, or where they haven't learned Welsh, they go into an immersion unit. So why aren't we doing that for the key drivers of learning, which are things like oracy and reading and the ability to manipulate language and basic number skills? You know, we are moving on before pupils have actually grasped those foundational principles. And so, of course, pupils who struggle more than that, you know, you keep on moving on, and advantaged pupils have got it. Disadvantaged pupils haven't. And then the gap widens, and then you're into the Matthew effect from Stanovich 1986, where you don't, you know, fix the reading problem, for example. And as they get older, it gets worse and worse and worse, and then becomes a bigger and bigger problem to fix. And we're doing ourselves a disservice because we're not fixing it when it's easy, when they're in the early years.
I'm thinking back to a question we asked Jeremy Miles, who was the last education minister, cabinet secretary for education, education boss at Welsh Government. I remember distinctly asking him about the size of the sandbox in which we play here in Wales, in Curriculum for Wales, and that there are obviously going to be really good bits of that sandbox that were never previously accessible to us, and there are going to be really rubbish bits of that sandbox that we should avoid like the plague. Things filter back from Welsh Government occasionally. I hear about sessions. I know it has been said that Curriculum for Wales is how we close the attainment gap. I have also heard it said that Curriculum for Wales is exacerbating the attainment gap, which I guess is possibly a brilliant example of the size of the sandbox in which we play in terms of the focus of today's episode. We're starting to hear stories coming out of schools where they've really got their story together and things are kind of really tight. We're starting to hear stories from schools where they've got themselves in an absolute cul-de-sac and there are no baddies in that story. They just have, because of the size of the sandbox in which they play. Was it ever a realistic prospect for the education system in Wales? We know why they've done it, but is it realistic to have done it in the way that they've done it?
So are you asking, was Curriculum for Wales ever going to fix the disadvantage gap?
Yes, I suppose, although I suppose the answer is that it can do if you get in the right bit of the sandbox. But is it realistic to expect us to find the right bit of such a big sandbox, the way that things have happened?
Well, I think the kind of the answer to that is that curriculum, or the sequencing in which the sequence of learning, is only one chapter in 14 of the book that I've got. So yes, it plays a part, but what's happened here, and we saw it when we were working with schools in Scotland, because obviously they're 10 years ahead of us, is that we went to a school, up in Perth a while ago, and we were giving them pedagogy, professional learning. And just as a kind of discussion in a break, I was talking to people and saying, you know, what's your professional learning been like? What's it like up in Scotland? What's going on? They said, oh, we haven't had anything outside of curriculum for years. And that's the problem here in Wales, is because curriculum reform and all of the bits of that, because it's not just the curriculum, there's all the other stuff that goes around that, has sucked all the money, all the time, all the expertise out of everything else. So there's that, but there's also, of course, you know, there's a piece of research that came out, I think, a couple of weeks ago, Berra Research. I think it was Nikki Lloyd, but I'm not sure, talking about the foundation phase and whether the foundation phase is actually going to raise standards in literacy and numeracy, which I know is the current Cabinet Secretary, Lynn Neagle's, one of her foci in developing for attainment, and it quite clearly isn't. And we have the enabling learning guidance, which is taking that foundation phase, you know, enabling adults instead of teachers in the classroom. I mean, anyone who's listened to our podcast has heard this before, but it's when you are struggling with learning, you need to be explicitly instructed and shown how to do it through a worked example, not, you know, left to discover it for yourself. And this is one of the things that is a bugbear of ours as well, is that looking at ESTIM reports where they talk about children need more opportunities to be learning independently. Do we ever learn entirely independently of anyone? Certainly when you're a novice, when you're in the very early stages, absolutely not. So just setting children off to do tasks on their own will not improve their independence long term. So there are some significant issues with the curriculum itself and the way it's structured and what schools and teachers are encouraged to make of it. But there's also just the practical terms of, if we're just focusing on one part of that solution, then other things, other more important things like the quality of teaching and learning, aren't being addressed.
I'm just going to bring us back to our student teachers and early career teachers who might be listening to this episode and the mentors who work closely with them. Something just struck me about what you just said was that, you know, do we ever learn independently? And a point you made even earlier in the episode about, you know, when you're witnessing a really expert master teacher in the classroom, you won't necessarily notice the hard work that's gone into what they're doing to support disadvantaged learners in the classroom. So advice, really, particularly to mentors working with student teachers and early career teachers, you know, what can they do to pull back the curtain, you know, and for the student teachers, if they're not getting that information, how can they spend their time, some of them, you know, over 9 months on a PGCE, to really start to understand a bit better the link between their practice and the outcomes it's having for their young people from disadvantaged backgrounds?
It's going back to the teaching and learning cycle. What am I teaching? What do I expect pupils to learn? Have they learnt it? And it's just as simple as that. And, you know, if you're... There's a lot of research about how using lesson observations to identify the quality of a teacher is notoriously inaccurate. So, you know, not really thinking about that, but what are the pupils doing? You know, from the student teacher and from anybody watching, is how do I know that they're thinking? Is there any evidence that they're thinking? Can I see them raising mini whiteboards or talking to their partners, or, you know, what did I expect the outcome to be, and how far away from that are they, or how close to that are they? Because this is all about, you would then think about, well, what questions would I use? What feedback would I give? You know, what prompts would I provide? And it's just part of the whole simple, what am I teaching? What are they learning? Have they learnt it?
And with that brilliant endorsement of all the lesson planning we make our student teachers do, for which a check is in the post, we should because it's not always popular, we should probably, before I come up with anything more controversial, bring that deep discussion to a close, I think. But that was really, really interesting. And now it's time to find out if you've done your homework, Finola. Homework being...
I did it on the bus on the way in.
Oh, well, what's the effect size of homework when you're an education consultant? Absolutely. I don't know. Something interesting and something to try. We will let you pick the order.
Okay, well, first? Just first of all, something interesting. There's a book out there by Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score. And not because it's particularly educational, but I think it's just really interesting to understand why children might be behaving the way they are. Because, you know, let's not forget that child development, you know, psychological understanding is one of the most useful skills that you can have. I mean, when I had my kids and I went back to teaching after having my own two sons, I saw my class completely differently. And I think it's understanding that the thoughts that children are having can be shaped by helping them use their behaviour to shape them. So if you've got a child who is constantly low-level disruptional, they're constantly acting out, is not just going, oh, well, they're just a really difficult child. It's they may be a really difficult child, but it's not their fault. And I'm not suggesting that you know teachers all become like research therapists or, you know, any of that, but it's just branching out a little bit and just trying to understand people a little bit more is kind of what I'm suggesting. And the Bessel van der Kolk book is just really interesting anyway, because it does talk about trauma, but it also talks about very practical ways in which people with trauma, PTSD, actually manage their own cognitive processes so that they can engage in life more fully. So just something interesting and something to try. And I've got like 5 things written down here.
That's a record. Go for it.
So I kind of, but the one thing that I think Jane and I keep on coming back to, and it kind of it serves as a structure for everything else, is the expertise reversal effect by Sweller in his cognitive load theory, which is the idea that as pupils' expertise grow, you take away the scaffolding. That there are 3 phases to this. The I do, where I'm standing in front of a class saying, this is the way you do it. Here is a fully worked example with all the steps. I'm going to make a mistake here and show you how to get over that mistake. I'll ask you a question about it. So that I do phase. Then at the end, there's the you do, fully independent phase. But the thing that I would kind of suggest that to go out and try is just have a think about how long do you spend in the we do phase. So the doing it together, a little bit of support, but also a little bit of independence. And what we see when we go out to schools is that teachers move swiftly from I do to you do, with maybe 2%, 3% of their time in the we do. And it probably should be more like 80, 85%. Mm. So something to try.
I saw a student maths teacher do the we do bit just beautifully. It's that whole idea that you're feigning incompetence in a way. Yeah. You kind of go, what was I supposed to do? Oh, I'm stuck. What would be a better word to use here? Or what was the problem that I needed to come back to? So then they have to help you. But you're still getting all that information about what they have and haven't understood when you were at the I do phase.
And it's just, you know, taking your fully worked example and maybe just taking out one of the steps.
Mm.
What's missing? Or taking all the steps, putting them in the wrong order.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just all the steps bar the last one. So it's just finding ways to gradually give them just a little bit more and more independence so that they then can do it fully independent. You can't just go from, look, this is the way to do it, just do it.
Yeah, really great one. Thank you very much, Finola. This has been a really interesting episode with lots of things to try, actually, but with the foundations of the good sort of thinking that needs to be done before you come to act in the classroom. Recommend that you all go out there and get your copy or access your copy of the book. And you're working on another one. Are you able to give us any?
I've submitted. It's gone. It's gone.
It was a nice feeling.
Oh, yes. So nice. It's the Illustrated Guide to Pedagogy. So it is essentially the last 10 years into one book. And it's just a kind of, if you want to be really good at teaching, this is what you need to do. And I'm very, very excited for that one. So that's coming out in January, February of next year. So it's a little bit early to be going out and buying it. But as soon as it's available, I'll be sharing it everywhere. So.
And you'll be back in here, no doubt.
Oh, you heard it here first, folks. Well, thank you very much, Finola. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in your ears in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Finola Wilson from Impact Wales, whose book Closing the Disadvantage Gap in Schools, a visual workbook, is out now. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambourne and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.